Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says it's clear the assassination of his country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was state-sponsored. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Execution says that the assassination of Iran's top scientist is a violation of international human rights law and UN Charter. And Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says that Iran's high-profile scientist was killed by those sponsored by America and Israel. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, a senior Iranian nuclear scientist has been assassinated near the nation's capital, Tehran. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh sustained serious injuries after his vehicle came under attack by terrorists in the city of Absard in the northern county of Damavand. He was transferred to hospital, but efforts to save him were unsuccessful. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. Meanwhile, the Iran's foreign minister has condemned the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, saying that there are serious indications of Israeli role. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that the assassination was an act of cowardice, which shows the desperate warmongering of its perpetrators. Zarif urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end its shameful double standards and condemn this act of state terror. Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador to the UN said it is clear that the assassination was state-sponsored and aimed at wreaking havoc in the region. Majid Takht-e Avanchi called on the UN Security Council to condemn the assassination, saying Iran won't shy away from deterring aggression or protecting its people. Iran's senior officials have condemned the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist and Deputy Defense Minister Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, pledged harsh revenge against those behind the terror attack. This was echoed by commanders of the Iranian Army and Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, as well as the intelligence minister. Meanwhile, the military advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution, Brigadier General Hossein Deighan, accused Israel of being behind the assassination. The former defense minister said that the regime seeks to intensify pressure on Iran in a bid to trigger full-fledged war. Deighan warned that Iran will descend like lightning on perpetrators involved in this assassination. Head of the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights says that the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist shows that enemies are determined to prevent Iran from making progress.
What is noteworthy from my point of view about the assassination attempt made today in Tehran was that there is a serious will by the Iranians' enemy to prevent the improvement and advancement of the Iranian people. They are going to put hurdles on our way.
Ali Bagheri said, however, that his country will become stronger and more motivated after this act of terror. Bagheri accused the U.S. and Israel of being behind the assassination. He said that Washington, after failure of its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, has resorted to terrorism. He also condemned the EU for its silence over the targeted killing, saying it's tantamount to supporting terrorism. Bagheri said Tehran will avenge the death of what he called this crime against the Iranian people. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Execution says the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is a violation of international human rights law.
An extraterritorial targeted killing outside an armed conflict is a violation of international human rights law prohibiting the arbitrary deprivation of life and a violation of the UN Charter prohibiting the use of force extraterritorially in times of peace.
Former director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has also described the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist as a highly reckless criminal act. In a series of tweets, John O. Brennan said that Fakhrizadeh's murder risks lethal retaliation and a new round of regional conflict. Meanwhile, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah condemned Fakhrizadeh's murder as a heinous attack sponsored by the U.S. and Israel. Hezbollah's deputy leader also stressed that the assassination was part of a war on Iran and the region. Sheikh Naim Qasim said the response to the murder is in Iran's hands. Yemen's Ansarullah and Palestinian Islamic Jihad movements also condemned the attack. Political commentator Daniel Kovalik says U.S. and Israel want to provoke Tehran into an armed conflict.
I was in Iran a few years ago and actually visited the memorial to other nuclear scientists who had been assassinated over the years, most likely by the Israeli security forces, Mossad. And probably it was Mossad that carried out this assassination with the U.S. Approval and maybe support. You know, remember that 2 weeks ago, New York Times had a story saying that Donald Trump had floated the idea of attacking nuclear sites within Iran. I guess he backed off on that, but this may be something else that he had ordered. So I think we can safely say the U.S. and Israel were behind this. It is a provocative act. I think the goal is to try to get Iran to retaliate in a way that could ratchet up tensions and possibly lead to an armed conflict. So it's a very dangerous time, and it was a very dangerous thing that was done. It violated international law, of course, and must be condemned in the strongest terms.
Political analyst Firas Al-Najim says this gruesome assassination has Israel written all over it.
And such influential people, and you know, they get killed in this type of gruesome and criminal way. I mean, this leads us always to have a suspect, and the suspect is always usually the Israeli regime. And it's not because we don't like the Israeli regime, it's because the Israeli regime is based on a history of assassinations and killings, and killing people that are obviously of intellect, that have strong insight, and that know what's really happening in the region, and that are supporting the resistance. And I guess he had a big role in supporting the resistance and the advancements of Iran. I mean, that this double standard system that the international community, the majority of it, and the EU is doing all the time is not working anymore, and it's not the right way to work. Why call out terrorist attacks in other places when things happen, and then when something like this happens in a country as Iran, they're all silent? You know, you don't hear nothing from Canada, unfortunately. We don't hear nothing from any other European country right now. They're all sitting there silently, but then when there's a little small attack somewhere in Palestine, a person trying to, stand up against an IDF soldier or something like that, they all governments and all regimes are sitting and you know, tweeting about it and making statements.
Now, the Polish Senate Speaker has warned the government against vetoing the European Union's new budget, saying it could lead to the country's exit from the European Union. Tomasz Grodzki said that a veto against the good of the country, as it could determine or undermine, that is, Poland's interests. Grodzki also warned that people will not forgive the government if this decision leads to Poland's divorce from the EU and loss of money for the country's development. On Thursday, Poland and Hungary issued a joint statement on their veto of the next EU budget and post-coronavirus recovery package after their prime ministers met in Budapest. They said they will seek to limit any rule of law conditionality tied to the budget, and that such a link needs to be further discussed. Meanwhile, the EU and UK say there are still major stumbling blocks to achieving a post-Brexit trade deal, with time quickly running out. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said two sides are still seeking to bridge substantial and important differences. He tried to shift the burden of responsibility for reaching an agreement on the EU, saying that a deal can be struck if they want to strike one. Meanwhile, EU Chief Negotiator Michel Barnier said the same significant divergences persist in the talks. One EU diplomat also said there are only a few days left for the talks. face-to-face Brexit trade talks will resume in London this weekend as the December 31st deadline looms. Negotiations are still centered on three main issues, namely fishing rights, state aid, and dispute resolution. British media say that Scottish First Minister wants to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. First vote back in 2014 saw a majority of Scots reject the bid for independence, but recent polls indicate more and more people are now in favor of secession from the United Kingdom. We discussed the issue earlier in our news review program. Here it is.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of News Review. British media say Scotland's First Minister is seeking to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. Madame Nicola Sturgeon has said she anticipates the vote will take place in the earlier part of the next Scottish Parliament. That term begins next year. Scotland held its first referendum on independence from Britain, if you recall, in 2014. 55% of voters said no, but 14 recent polls have shown a majority of Scots now support independence. Such sentiment has gained momentum following Britain's exit from the European Union. Widespread criticism over the British government's handling of the pandemic is contributed to. London is against a new referendum in the near future. It says the previous vote should be respected. And that's what we'll be discussing in this edition of News Review with guests who kindly join us from London. I have Amina Taylor. She's our correspondent in the British capital, as well as Mr. John White. He's an author and commentator who joins us via Skype out of Edinburgh itself. Guests, very good to have you with us. I'm going to begin with London and, you know, the sentiment against it and, you know, the fact that London says it's soon. Is it?
Well, Westminster would say that, wouldn't it? Because quite frankly, they would have seen how the wind is blowing in this particular scenario. I was one of the leading correspondents who went up in 2011 when they were really pushing forward for even the right to be able to stage the referendum, because of course at that time the Conservative government was putting obstacles in place. This was just before Nicola Sturgeon's tenure here, and there were so many conversations about even if Holyrood had the right to demand the ability to ask its own people about what should happen in terms of taking their destiny on board. And I do remember the polling at that time, it was around 60-40, and even that was some improvement. So it was seen as a long shot. Now, fast forward to 2014, when I was also on location in Scotland in the weeks leading up to that referendum, it was close. But one of the fundamental things that actually swayed it in the direction of no for independence was the fact that Scotland would be seen to be moving away from the European Union, with the European Union saying, listen, we don't really like separatist situations as they don't for Catalonia and their bid for independence. So if you were to break away, well, you'd be pretty much on your own for a while. Well, they might not like to admit this, but the sands have shifted dramatically. You cannot have a Brexit scenario where Scotland overwhelmingly, I think about 56% of the total votes in Scotland, John might be able to correct me here on this, were definitely pro-EU. So you cannot have this situation where Westminster's pulling in one direction, Edinburgh's trying to pull in another, and the people of Scotland are trying to kind of be in that middle ground where London's calling the shots, but they're not respecting the wishes of those on the ground. I just don't see how this is tenable. I really don't.
Mm. John White in Edinburgh, of course,
Amina made mention, and you know, true in that, you know, made mention of the issue of the Brexit scenario, and of course, you know, staying away from the European Union, not a favorable stance by the Scots. You're in Edinburgh yourself. Just tell us how the feeling, you know, back in 2011, 2014, there was no talk of Brexit, yet there was a referendum, and, you know, so there are, it seems to me that there are, you know, factors above and beyond this issue of Brexit.
Well, the genie of Scottish independence is well and truly out of the bottle, and it's not going to be put back in again. The argument in favour of Scottish independence has been won. What's yet to take place is the political struggle by which to achieve it. I mean, it's absolutely correct. A main plank of the No campaign in 2014, a main argument was that if Scotland wanted to stay in the European Union, it would have to remain in the UK. And a lot of people were swayed by that argument. Nobody in their right mind would have believed that just 2 years later, in service to an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Rule Britannia was abroad and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased, that Britain would take this calamitous step of coming out of the largest free trading bloc in the world. And that's come to pass. So the game has changed. COVID has only accelerated the trend towards Scottish independence due to the shambolic handling of this virus by Westminster, opposed relative to Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, who's widely been perceived as being very competent and assured in her handling of COVID. So the argument's been won. The politics has been won in favour of Scottish independence. The UK is the very epitome of an artificial state. Different cultures, different histories, antagonistic in relation to England for much of their histories, Ireland, Wales and Scotland. And so the linchpin of the British state, the UK, was an industrial working class that cohered around the common trade union struggles. But the UK no longer is an industrial nation and no longer has an industrial base. And so the different cultures, regional and national, have now come to the fore. And that's been reflected in the politics and the votes, i.e. in terms of the Brexit referendum, where Scotland actually, 62% of Scotland voted to remain. That translates to every single one of Scotland's 32 local authorities. So it's Scottish independence is an idea whose time has come, but it's only going to come on the back of a very fierce political struggle next year.
All right, guests, many, many thanks for joining us and discussing this with me. Amina Taylor, our correspondent in London, always well-informed and nice. John White, author and commentator from Edinburgh via Skype. I really appreciate the time you gave us this hour.
Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko says he will step down after the country adopts a new constitution. Lukashenko also stressed the need for amendments to that constitution and adjustments to presidential powers. Belarus has been gripped by anti-government protests since the August presidential election, which gave Lukashenko a sixth term in office. Protests then broke out after rival contender Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya cried foul play in the electoral process and demanded Lukashenko resign. Long-serving president, however, denied the allegations, accusing Western nations of being behind the protests and interfering in Belarusian internal affairs. Now, the alleged war crimes by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan have caused outrage. People and rights groups have demanded perpetrators be brought to justice. Amin Alami in Kabul has also asked locals about this very issue.
Not only Australian forces, but others will kill us if we continue to ignore each other's will. This is clear that they provided some specific figures with dollars and heavy vehicles while our people are trampled.
It's quite clear that the responsible Australian forces must be prosecuted, and the prosecution process must be widely covered by media outlets to advocate victims' rights.
We want the ICC as a responsible body in this regard to seriously investigate the killing of civilians by Australian forces and punish them.
Thank you for tuning in and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you a fortnight ago, and here are ayahs 51, 52, 53, 54, and 55 of Surah Dukhan.
إن المتقين في مقام أمين في جنات وعيون يلبسون من سندس وإستبرق متقابلين كذلك وزوجناهم بحور عين يدعون فيها بكل فاكهة آمنين.
Indeed, the God-weary will be in a secure place, amid gardens and springs, dressed in fine silk and brocade, sitting face to face. So shall it be, and we shall wed them to black-eyed houris. There they will call for every fruit in safety. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the preceding ayahs of this surah, we said that, on Resurrection Day, the unbelief of unbelievers and the sins of unrepentant sinners take the form of intense fire, horribly burning both the outwards and inwards of those cast into hell. This punishment will be both physical and psychological, since the tyrants, who thought they were mighty, powerful, and wealthy, will have to suffer the consequences of their crimes against humanity and God, the all-merciful Creator, who never wrongs anyone, and it is only the disbelievers and intransigent sinners who wrong themselves. In contrast, the ayahs that we recited to you now depict the situation of the virtuous and God-fearing persons who are granted the bliss of paradise, saying they will be in a safe place, immune from any grief, pain, anxiety, and calamity, amid gardens and fresh flowing springs, where their garments will be of the finest fabrics of silk and brocade. They will have luxurious couches to sit upon and enjoy, in an atmosphere of friendship and amity with each other, the rewards of their faith in God and their good deeds. The men will be married to the most beautiful females called Huris, who are of delicate white complexion and endowed with lovely glowing black eyes of wide dimensions. For the people of paradise, all kinds of pure, fresh, and delicious food, fruits, and drinks will be available without any trouble. One should, however, not get the wrong impression that paradise is only for men, since God Almighty has granted a special status in heaven for the faithful and virtuous women as well. In short, these ayahs indicate both the spiritual and physical pleasures of paradise, since in the same manner that every human being is essentially composed of soul and body, the divine bounties are consistent with spirituality and corporeality. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Serenity and security are among the most important divine bounties, and this is the reason these have been mentioned here before the other bounties of heaven, where there is no anxiety and fear or even any concern of loss and death. Number 2. What takes a person to paradise is faith in the one and only Creator of the universe, coupled with good deeds in line with obedience to His commandments as elaborated by His messengers, that is, the prophets and the imams, who set the practical example of refraining from forbidden words and actions through leading of a virtuous life, even in the most adverse circumstances, without the least fear of evil persons and tyrants. Number 3. The eternal bliss of paradise is a place where both spiritual and corporeal pleasures gather as rewards for the true believers. And number 4. In paradise, the atmosphere of perpetual peace, amity, and friendship prevails with no trace of any negative attitudes, such as enmity, hatred, jealousy, grudge, greed, envy, or even sickness and disease. Now let us listen to ayahs 56 and 57 of this surah.
لا يذوقون فيها الموت إلا الموتة الأولى ووقاهم عذاب الجحيم فضلا من ربك ذلك هو الفوز العظيم.
There they will not taste death except the first death of the mortal world, and he will save them from the punishment of hell. This is a grace from your Lord. That is the great success. After resurrection, there will be no death, neither for those cast into the blazing fire of hell, nor for those granted the bliss of paradise. This eternity, whether in the state of severe torment for the disbelievers or in perpetual comfort for the true believers, is the result of their own beliefs and deeds. As mentioned in several places in the Noble Quran, which says that those who enter paradise will remain therein forever, safe from the fires of hell. This is indeed the grace of the all-merciful God, who grants this great success to the virtuous believers as an infinite reward for the sincerity of their good deeds, however trivial. From these ayahs, we learn that, 1, those granted the bliss of paradise will remain therein forever, while from among those cast into hell, in contrast to the eternally damned disbelievers, the sinful believers not forgiven during life will be shifted to heaven after the fire had cleansed them of the gravity of their sins. 2, God grants safety from the fire of hell to those who fulfill the divine obligations and abstain from sins, as well as to those who sincerely repent of their sins and reform themselves by seeking forgiveness from the Lord Most High. 3, no one can claim that his or her good deeds are comparable to the great bounties granted to us by the all-merciful God, including the reward of paradise, which is indeed a divine grace. Now we listen to ayahs 58 and 59 of Surah Dukhan.
فَإِنَّمَا يَسَّرْنَاهُ بِلِسَانِكَ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَذَكَّرُونَ فَارْتَقِبْ إِنَّهُمْ مُرْتَقِبُونَ.
Indeed, we have made the Quran simple in your language so that they may take admonition. So wait. Indeed, they too are waiting. These concluding ayahs of Surah Dukhan indicate that the goal of divine revelation is to admonish mankind and awaken them from negligence. In other words, the purpose of the Noble Quran is to make human beings realize that they are the creatures of the one and only God, and therefore should not stray from the straight and unwavering path towards paradise that saves them from the pitfalls of hell. These ayahs mean to say that God Almighty sent down the Noble Quran in the Arabic language as the final heavenly scripture to all mankind, so that upon observing its flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom, they perceive that it springs from the springhead of divine emanation. Moreover, unlike scientific books that are not easy to grasp for most people and meant for specialists only, the Noble Quran is understandable to the general public, and everyone can perceive it according to his or her level of knowledge. This enables them to believe in the universal mission of the last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Prophet, for his part, expounded the meanings of these divine words, which means that those who refuse to use their God-given intellect to accept facts and realities have to await the wrath of the all-merciful Lord. The Prophet awaits the divine promise of the ultimate triumph of Islam, while the disbelievers are merely waiting in vain for their evil intentions. These ayahs teach us the following points. 1, the message of the Quran, though in flawless Arabic, is easy to understand, while scholars in every age and place, as per the teachings of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, explain its finer points to the public in simple language. 2, God Almighty, by raising a long line of prophets in every age and place, along with heavenly scriptures for the guidance of humanity, has sealed his argumentation, culminating in the finality of divine revelation in the form of the Noble Quran to his last and greatest messenger, with the universal mission of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. And number three, if the intransigence of disbelievers refuse to use their God-given intellect to accept the truth, then they should await divine wrath. Dear listeners, that marks the end of Surah Dukhan, and next Friday we will embark on explanation of Surah 47 titled Al-Jathiyah. Until then, goodbye and God bless you.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام أول شيء خلقه من خلقه الشيء الذي جميع الأشياء منه وهو الماء.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The first thing that Allah created from His creation was the substance that all things come from, and that is water."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in a very interesting discussion between one of the students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi with his teacher, who is none other than Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. Now, this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is a very long discussion. It is a very long conversation. But this conversation and this dialogue between the student and the teacher and the student, we find that there are excellent and golden pieces of advice. There is wisdom beyond imagination. Now, one of the pieces of advice which was given to Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi in this dialogue between these two is where Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, O Jabir, regard as much the little livelihood from Allah to be loyal to gratefulness, and regard as little your obedience to Allah to belittle yourself and to ask Allah for forgiveness. Drive away the present evil from yourself through the present knowledge which you have, and put into effect the present knowledge sincerely. In such few words, dear friends, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this dialogue with his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, puts through such amazing words of wisdom and knowledge. Imam al-Baqir says that we should regard even the least amount of livelihood which we have from Allah and be grateful for that little livelihood. How many people are there in the world whom are starving to death? How many people are in the world who don't have an income? How many people are in the world who, under unjust sanctions, have little to no income, have little to no food, have little to no medicine? And so Imam al-Baqir tells Jabir here, regard your livelihood, even if it is little, to be a great blessing from Allah. And furthermore, regard your obedience and your worship and your good deeds to be little. Do not become arrogant, thinking that your good deeds and your obedience to Allah is such a great thing. He says, always remember to ask for forgiveness, and in order to drive away and remove the evil that is within us because of our own decisions and our own choices, is to put the knowledge which we have into effect sincerely. Meaning, we know that something is wrong, then sincerely put that knowledge into action and don't do something which is wrong. On the other hand, we know that something is right, put that knowledge into effect sincerely and do that which is right. Beautiful pieces of advice given to Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi in this dialogue by his teacher, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Qur'an and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Qadada asked a question. فَأَخْبِرْنِي عَنِ الْجُبْنِ. We go back to the cheese. He says, oh Imam, tell me about the cheese. What is the ruling about it? And Imam laughed at him, in a way smiled at him, تَبَسَّمَ Abu Ja'far, and said, رَجَعَتْ مَسَائِلُكَ إِلَى هَذَا. You had come with so many questions, and this is the question you are putting in forward? You know, asking me about cheese? He says, well, you know, I'm confused about this issue. So Imam says, لا بأس به. There is no problem in cheese. It is halal, you can eat. Now this faqih of Basra says, إِنَّهُ رُبَّمَا جُعَتْ فِيهِ إِنْفَحَتُ الْمَيِّتِ. But sometimes when they make the cheese, they use the rennet from an animal which was mayyit. Mayyit means either dead by itself or was not slaughtered according to Islamic method. So it was not a zabiha. Imam says, لَيْسَ بِهِ بَعْسِ. There is no problem. Still there is no problem. Even if that cheese contained the rennet from an animal which was not slaughtered in the Islamic manner. Why? إِنَّ الْإِنْفَحَ لَيْسَ لَهَا أُرُوقٌ وَلَا فِيهَا دَمٌ وَلَا لَهَا عَظْمٌ. Imam says this rennet, this enzyme, doesn't have veins in it, there's no blood in it, there's no bones in it, and therefore, you know, there is no problem in it.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Soul of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Dr. Helen Yaff of Glasgow University, author of We Are Cuba, How a Revolutionary People Have Survived in a Post-Soviet World, said, Cuba now has four COVID-specific vaccine candidates under clinical trial. The fact that a small Caribbean island can achieve such a remarkable feat is testimony to its state-owned biotech sector, which is directed towards public health demands and integrated into its healthcare and education systems. After years of being told that only the market can lead to efficiency and innovation, Cuba's socialist planned economy demonstrates what is possible when there is political will, good coordination, organization, and the priority of social welfare. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod, staff writer of Min Press News, under the heading, Cuba could be on the brink of a revolutionary COVID vaccine, but U.S. sanctions are slowing it down. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. Cuba has announced positive and promising results for a number of separate COVID-19 vaccines it is currently developing. But U.S. sanctions against the small island nation are hampering the development and rollout of the potentially life-saving treatments. Two candidates named Sovereign 1 and Sovereign 2 have generated antibodies blocking infection in animals and are showing similarly encouraging signs on tests on human subjects. Meanwhile, a separate vaccine based on a protein from the hepatitis B virus is unique in that it is delivered through
the nasal tract and does not require a needle to administer. Should any of these efforts ultimately succeed, the Caribbean nation, already a medical powerhouse that has developed a long cancer vaccine and methods to stop mother-to-baby HIV and syphilis transmission, will likely become an important supplier to other Latin American and developing countries who have been effectively shut out from purchasing COVID vaccines from Western companies, as rich nations have already begun hoarding coronavirus medicines. Dr. Helen Yaff of Glasgow University, author of We Are Cuba, How a Revolutionary People Have Survived in a Post-Soviet World, was impressed and heartened by the news, telling Mint Press, Cuba now has four COVID-specific vaccine candidates under clinical trial. The fact that a small Caribbean island can achieve such a remarkable feat is testimony to its state-owned biotech sector, which is directed toward public health demands and integrated into its healthcare and education systems. After years of being told that only the market can lead to efficiency and innovation, Cuba's socialist planned economy demonstrates what is possible when there is political will, good coordination, organization, and the priority of social welfare. However, Cuban immunization developments are being seriously hamstrung by the actions of the U.S. government, primarily due to the decades-long blockade on the island, something which the Cuban government estimates has costed over $750 billion. As Reuters reported, cash-strapped Cuba cannot afford to buy the raw materials necessary to upscale its vaccine development to help other countries. Hospitals face huge obstacles importing life-saving equipment from abroad due to the blockade, while the sanctions force the country, which imports the large majority of its staples, to spend far more on food than other nations. As a result, according to the World Food Program, almost one-third of young children suffer from anemia due to the monotonous and subpar nutrition available. Food production is hampered. With little petroleum available for agriculture, the country instead went back to rely on human or animal labor. The blockade also led to the forced development of a domestic pharmaceutical and biotechnology sector, which has grown to become among the most advanced in the world. Last November, the United Nations voted 187-3 in favor of ending the blockade, with the U.S., the Zionist regime, and Brazil voting no. Almost two-thirds of Americans support an end to the action as well. Despite this, the Trump administration has in fact intensified the pressure on Cuba, as Dr. Yaff explained. Cuba has been subject to an additional 46 sanctions and new measures to tighten the blockade, to scare off foreign investors, to create a scarcity, to create difficulty for Cuba to access raw materials, including for its biotech sector and for its pharmaceutical industry. Yaff notes in her new documentary entitled Cuba and COVID-19, Public Health, Science and Solidarity, one example of this is that the island can no longer purchase ventilators or parts for existing machines because the Swiss company it dealt with was purchased by an American one, and fearing potential reprisals, it halted any contact with Havana. A more positive but nevertheless difficult challenge the Cuban government faces in testing its new vaccines is the lack of COVID-19 patients on the island, which has the highest proportion of medical professionals per capita anywhere in the world. To date, the country has recorded only 7,639 cases and 131 deaths. U.S.-backed conservative neighbors such as Brazil, Ecuador, and until recent weeks, Bolivia, that had expelled Cuban doctors working inside their borders, have fared far worse. Under Trump, the U.S. also led the world in the theft of medical equipment and personal protective gear, confiscating shipments and diverting supplies away from other countries to keep for itself. And at the height of the outbreak in Iran, the government was unable to buy or import life-saving gear due to cruel American sanctions, as no nation was willing to risk the wrath of hawkish Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who threatened harsh sanctions on anyone willing to do business with Iran. Finally, the World Health Organization directly intervened, gifting Iran supplies, sparking the Trump administration to leave WHO, among other reasons. The U.S., along with other wealthy nations, has also been quietly buying up the majority of any future supply of vaccines, concerning the market and leaving little hope for developing nations to secure their own supply of vaccines. The for-profit corporations conducting their research have made it clear that they intend to withhold production secrets in order to cash in. Furthermore, they do not have the capacity to immunize the entire world. For example, the U.S. German company predicts that it could supply enough for only around 650 million people by the end of 2021. This is why the development of treatments outside the for-profit model is so important. Recently, Pfizer claimed that its own trial, featuring over 43,000 people in six countries, was a success, with a 90% immunization rate and only 94 people contracting the virus from the vaccine. Massachusetts-based Moderna claims that its vaccine is even more effective, with a 94% immunization rate and does not have to be stored at 80 degrees centigrade temperature like Pfizer offering. The first country to announce a potential vaccine was Russia, however. The government sharing the news in September with researchers saying Sputnik V was 90% effective and that Russia could produce 500 million doses annually. The Russian and American offerings appear to be based upon the same scientific logic and have produced broadly similar results. However, the Russian vaccine has been near universally panned in the Western press, while the American ones heralded as a historic achievement. Thus, Sky News headline described Pfizer breakthrough as a great day for science and humanity, while casting doubt on the validity of Sputnik V, claiming the Russian secretive approach is a throwback to its spirit in the Cold War. Regardless if any or all of the treatments work, the world will need a sustained and coordinated international effort to immunize itself against COVID-19, as no one company can possibly supply the entire planet. By continuing the blockade against Cuba, the U.S. government might be condemning much of the world to living months longer under a deadly pandemic that has claimed the lives of over 1.32 million people.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.